listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
Welcome, everybody, to this event. My name is Hamish Jenkins from the UN Non-Governmental Liaison Service, NGLS, which works informally between the UN system and civil society organizations, especially on cross-cutting emerging issues, including bringing to the UN underrepresented voices. And this event is organized in partnership with the UN Research Institute for Social Development and Community Forge, a local NGO working on solidarity economy here in Geneva. And basically the theme is solidarity and alternative finance, a different development model. The motivation, at least for NGLS and UNRWS to organize this event, is very much to try and follow up on the Rio Plus 20 conference and more precisely on the relationship between the official conference and the People's Summit, which took place in Flamingo Park in Rio de Janeiro while the official conference was miles away in some new modern neighborhood. And those who spent time in Flamingo Park probably had a much better experience of that conference. There were obviously many, how would I say, differences between the way the thrust of the official conference and the thrust of the what was said at the People's Summit. There were lots of contentious issues around the green economy. You heard Gus Macia yesterday talk about it, Martin Kohl also made allusion to that on the opening. But one very positive element, as the presentation of Pascal Delisle yesterday intimated, is that despite the critique of the existing economic model that the People's Summit projected on the official conference, there was also efforts to promote an alternative that is beginning to gain some maturity, which is called sometimes just the solidarity economy, sometimes a social solidarity economy, which is basically a different mode of production, distribution, and consumption from, let's say, the mainstream economic model. I'm not going to try and define it because we have some very competent people around the table to talk about it, but it is based on the values of cooperation, complementarity, mutual support, and is firmly enshrined in the principles of human rights and democratic governance, especially at the local level. And for those of you who had a chance to be in Rio, you would have heard that there are a myriad of practical examples that show that this model actually does work and just is waiting to be scaled up to a more sizable proportion. In fact, it was very interesting to see at a meeting where some of the views of the People's Summit were brought at the official conference through an event where a number of governments express their support and their intention to try and scale up the solidarity economy to be treated genuinely as a third sector of the economy. So it's not just something on the margins to deal with the the dark face of capitalism, or just to try and put a more human face to the mainstream economic model, but that it can be a different development model, a third sector of the economy that can coexist, at least to some extent, with the conventional economy. And some governments, including France, Ecuador, and others, Ecuador has already gone further in that regard and have passed a law on they're calling it the solidarity and popular economy, which popular economy is often the word used to refer to the informal economy, as a third sector that requires specific legal, institutional, and financial support systems that are specific to its nature. So what we have here is a way to try and introduce the subject at the UN, probably at least from my knowledge for the first time. We had a few seminars on elements of the solidarity economy, looking a lot at the financial aspects with the former Minister of Economic Coordination of Ecuador, Pedro Paez, that we organized in partnership with UNEP and EcoAttitude, as well as one that was done earlier with a rather famous professor on issues around alternative financial systems named Bernard Lietard. And many of the people who are in this room have followed these previous seminars. So what we have today is first a brief, I guess, introduction by Peter Utting, who's a deputy director of UNRIST, who'll talk about general trends and issues on the solidarity economy, and also announce a very interesting international research project on this that should culminate with an international conference sometime next year. Secondly, we have Frédéric Lapeyre, who's employment and informal economy specialist at the International Labour Organization, the ILO, which is in a way the agency of the UN that has been most in advance in terms of trying to understand and develop the social and solidarity economy in the context of the problems of informality that is so widespread in the developing world. And Frédéric will be telling us a little bit about the ILO research on this topic. And then finally, coming from a rather different angle, we are very pleased to announce that we have with us Thomas Greco, who's director of the Community Information Resource Center in the US. I mean, some of you in the room are well familiar with Thomas's work. He's a writer, networker, consultant, specializing in monetary theory and history, credit clearing systems, complementary currencies, and community economic development. He's a tenured college professor and has written a number of books. The most recent one is called The End of Money and the Future of Civilization, but he's produced a number of other books, Understanding and Creating Alternative Legal Tender. Basically, following on what I was saying earlier, it'd be very interesting to hear from Thomas. Very difficult in just 10 minutes, but to see how the solidarity economy would need or could certainly be tremendously supported with alternative financial support systems that may include complementary currencies at the local level. So without further ado, I will turn the floor to Peter to start this discussion.
Thanks, Hamish, and many thanks to NGLS for taking this initiative, and UNRIST is really pleased to be part of a process which we hope will gather momentum to raise the visibility of these issues about social and solidarity economy in the UN system. We know a lot's going on in academic circles, in civil society, advocacy circles. Some governments, as Hamish mentioned, are taking initiatives, but in these circuits, still a lot has to be discussed and debated. So we very much support this process. I'll just make some very general points about some of the things we see happening in this field. I'll be using the term social and solidarity economy, which is the term that's being increasingly used to have a more overarching umbrella term for social economy, solidarity, popular, whatever economy. And I'll say a bit about certain trends taking place in terms of diversification and expansion of this field. A few points about what seems to be driving this whole phenomenon, and then refer back to the question in the poster flyer for this event is does solidarity economy point to a different development model? So I think a rule of history which we know very well is that in times of crisis and human insecurity due to market failures or market forces, there's always a societal reaction. and societal forces tend to respond, both as a sort of a coping strategy and also to transform what we can call business as usual. And when societal forces do respond, three things tend to happen. One is that people assume more direct control over production and exchange. They then also organize and mobilize to influence policy and institutions and to sort of reframe our common sense understandings of what development and development priorities are all about. And then we also see conventional organizations and enterprises and elites to some extent will respond and they will adapt, and sometimes in ways that are more socially responsive. Now, it's this dynamic that I think we see playing out in this whole field of social and solidarity economy. We see it in terms of the diversification of this field. So we have the old sort of traditional social economy, solidarity economy, enterprises and organizations like cooperatives, like mutual associations, charitable foundations, etc. But what we've seen, particularly in the last two decades, is new types of organizations. Their profile has been raised significantly. So we have the sort of women's self-help groups getting into sort of enterprise activities, community organizers, the fair trade producer groups, unions, trade unions of informal sector workers organizing, and NGOs who are facing constraints on funding and reliance on grants and state funding, getting more into trying to earn an income to survive. Now, and we see the sort of signs that social and solidarity economy is growing in other respects. The significant work by the ILO sort of points to the revival of cooperatives, particularly in Africa and Latin America. They say 1 in 7 people in Africa belong to a cooperative-type organization. In Kenya, for example, there are 3,500 savings and credit co-ops with 4 million members. In India, there's so much going on. We have dairy cooperatives, we're estimated to have 12 million members, producing 20% of the milk production there. Over two million self-help groups, and I think 85 to 90% of those are women's self-help groups. 8 million households involved in community forestry initiatives or groups. In Nepal, another 15,000 community forestry initiatives. In Nicaragua, the major rural development program now is really a social economy initiative which organizes rural women producers into groups of 50 women, and now is reaching 100,000 women. And this, in Brazil, health cooperative services reach 17 million people. The whole fair trade movement has developed, and back in 2010, it was estimated that fair trade represented a $6 billion market now. So we see this proliferation, this sort of expansion taking place. And what we also see is more of a sort of enabling environment where other actors, states, governments, civil society movements and networks are facilitating this expansion. For example, in Brazil and now in France, there's a secretariat or ministry of social economy. We see regional policies and laws being developed particularly in South America and the European Union. Policies associated with smallholder empowerment very prominent on the international development agenda now. There are growing sort of civil society networks promoting social enterprise, which are now have a sort of a global scale. Trade unions getting much more into organizing informal sector workers, for example, the Federation StreetNet, and large peasant or landless movements of landless workers, such as Via Campesina, the MST in Brazil, or the march that began yesterday in India of Ekta Parishad of 50,000 tribal peoples to secure better land rights. Now, on the drivers, so what's driving all this phenomenon? I think a number of conditions have coalesced both to expand and to transform social and solidarity economy in the last two decades. maybe five sort of stand out for me. One is the what we've seen over two decades is in the context of sort of the rolling back of the state, state intervention, state services, etc. This opens up a space for social and solidarity economy organizations and enterprises. We've obviously, in that context, we saw the rise of NGOs and more recently of social enterprises. The other has been the social effects of structural adjustment programs, what generally is called neoliberal policies. And in the context of difficult social conditions, is the sort of rise of precarious employment and precarious smallholder agriculture. And so social solidarity economy initiatives arise very much as a sort of a coping strategy in difficult socioeconomic conditions. There's also been a shift in bilateral aid policy, leaning more towards trade, not aid, and promoting very much, particularly in recent years, the economic empowerment of small producers and micro enterprises, with the idea that producers need to cooperate and associate to increase their bargaining power, to get better terms in market relations, and to lower their transaction costs. The fourth would obviously be the rise of in information communication technologies and the whole networking culture and experience, which facilitates learning about different experiences and facilitates the replication of those experiences, and of course, civil society advocacy. And finally, we've got the context of the multiple global crises: food, energy, finance, economics. And crisis tends to do three things. One, it encourages workers and producers to associate, to come together as a coping strategy. So we saw the phenomenon, for example, after the Argentinian peso crisis of workers taking over factories there. Crises also obviously mobilize social movements and communities to demand alternatives. And they force policymakers and elites to adjust and to rethink to some extent the nature of the development model they're promoting. So coming to the question on the flyer, so does social and solidarity economy make a difference in terms of the development model? Now, much of the literature, as Hamish mentioned, and the advocacy suggests it does, but we also know there's a tendency in much of the literature and the advocacy to embellish achievements and sometimes romanticize the potential. What I think we see happening in this field is the following. There are very different approaches to development within the field of social and solidarity economy. And we can see this by looking at the different responses there are to the food, energy, climate change, and financial crises. A grosso modo, we can sort of identify three pathways. One we can call the response to crisis is to stabilize market liberalism. Okay? So we bail out the banks, we tweak financial regulations, we promote things like sustainable intensification of agriculture, eco-efficiency, corporate social responsibility. Aid and government policy promotes entrepreneurialism, economic empowerment, small producers, as I mentioned, and austerity cuts public services, but, as we saw, opens up these spaces for certain types of social enterprise. The second pathway we can call embedded liberalism. So the embedded liberalism pathway accepts the reality that we have capitalist institutions, we have capitalist relations, but we have to negotiate a social compromise to mitigate the negative effects of market forces. So the historic social compromise in Europe was the welfare state, was universal social policy. The challenge now under the embedded liberal model is to design a 21st century social contract. So initiatives like the global social floor, etc., conform to that. And also the idea of a new Green Deal, dealing with the environmental and sustainable development challenges. So this sort of pathway favors very much social enterprise, fair trade, more support for cooperatives, women's empowerment through self-help groups and other organisations, community associations, and the unionisation of informal sector workers. All these elements can be seen as part of this new social contract, contemporary social contract. The third pathway is, we can call, as they do in the People's Summit in Rio, the alter globalization pathway. So this calls for a very different approach to growth. Major changes in growth and consumption patterns, different social and power relations, the dismantling of the campaign that got going in the People's Summit, dismantling corporate power. And we see new concepts, new ideas, discourses, new values associated with things like food sovereignty, degrowth or décroissance, buen vivir, as in the term in Latin America, voluntary simplicity related to consumption patterns. So all these pathways, to some extent, are promoting some forms of the organizations and enterprises we would put under this umbrella of social and solidarity economy. So what we're seeing at UNRIST, and I'll come on to the new project we're about to launch, is that if we're going to really understand the developmental implications, social, environmental, etc., of social and solidarity economy, we need to look at how social solidarity economy is connecting or relating to the state, market relations and market forces, global value chains and corporations, and to civil society networks and social movements. And it's because it's these relations that really determine, to a large extent, the sort of development orientation of social and solidarity economy. So what we've done yesterday at UNRIST, or was it the day before, we launched a new project, research inquiry, which we're calling the Potential and Limits of Social and Solidarity Economy. And there's a flyers on the table outside referring to this. What we'll do initially is do it through a call for papers leading up to a research conference in May, 6 to 8 May next year. And what we want to do here is particularly focus on what are the conditions, the institutional, political, economic, cultural, etc., that can come together to create a sort of enabling environment for scaling up social economy, expanding social economy. And ask the question, as social and solidarity economy expands, how will the increasing, which is inevitable, interactions with markets, with governments, and relations with civil society networks, how will that affect the, sort of the character, the quality of social and solidarity economies? We know these links, for example, with the state are crucial for scaling up, but what happens to the nature of the enterprises en route?
Time
is up, so I'll leave two examples for later of the tensions and challenges. Just to say that this call was just launched yesterday, and we're inviting research papers on four themes. One is conceptualization, measurement, and appraisal of social and solidarity economy. Second is expanding analysis of what happens when social and solidarity economy is expanded through market relations. A third is on what needs to be done to enable social and solidarity economy through public policy and the state and government. And finally, the one on social movements, networks, and the politics of change. So I invite you to pick up the flyer. You're on our website, www.unrist.org. You can consult the longer concept note and call for papers. And, of course, you're all invited to the conference in May 2013. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. In fact, when you were explaining the last part in terms of how you're framing your inquiry, I think if we want to engage not just, as you say, the romantics, but also the hard-nosed economists, I can see one colleague from UNCTAD in the room, but to see how, you know, we're not just talking about small is beautiful, but also how, you know, the small networks of cooperatives can also themselves become value chains, distribution chains. That's one path that the new coordinator of the intercontinental network on the social solidarity economy, now based in the Philippines, Paul Quiñones, was really wanting to push in the context of Asia, is to see how, without falling into the large corporate trap, that you can actually bring certain things to scale within this different production, distribution, and consumption model. Where, for example, the fair trade in agriculture for the moment is just a kind of north-south thing, whereas we could really have fair trade, organic production in Asia with proper production and distribution channels following a different pathway than just engaging in the existing value chains. But that's just one thing to do. So without further ado, we'll turn to Frédéric Lapeyre. As for those who arrived late, he works at the ILO and is one of the people who's working on social and solidarity economy, and we'll talk about the ILO research on this in relation to the informal economy.
Thank you very much. Hamish?
No, it's okay, I will speak like that.
It's okay?
Yes, yes. Otherwise, we will have to turn to the screen. The screen is over there. No, it's better like that. So, good afternoon to everybody. I would like to thank Hamish, that I know for a long time now, and NGLS for the invitation for the ILO. So, as you know, we are in 2012. So it means that it's the 40th anniversary of the seminal ILO mission in Kenya, where for the first time the UN agency worked on the what we can call popular urban economic practices in what will be called the informal sector. And since then, the ILO has never stopped to work on this issue of informal sector, informal economy. Now about what we speak about informal employment. And the main reason is that the great majority of workers in the world are trapped in informal employment, and in developing countries, most of the workers are trapped in informal employment within the informal economy. So it's a priority for the ILO for a long time now, and we have a new DG who was elected last June, and among the seven priorities of the new DG, informal economy is one. Informal employment is one. So it's very important for us. And if we think about the issue of informal employment, you know, there is a huge debate now at international level with G8, G20, and also we heard about in Rio, and all, everywhere, about we need job. We need job creation, and we need to fight global decent work deficits. And what we can see through main demands of youth in the Arab Springs or in the streets of Greece or Spain, that if we don't create jobs within the formal employment in the formal economy, but also if we are unable to improve the condition of employment within the informal economy, then growth will not be conducive to poverty reduction, but it will be conducive to more and more social tension, social conflicts, and to big problems in terms of social ties and social cohesions, but also in terms of sustainable growth at national and global level. And then it's in this framework that we have started to think about the social economy, social and solidarity economy, and what could be the contribution of a social and solidarity economy to the job creation and decent work agenda. Mm-hmm. And the starting point is to say that informal is not normal. But what we can say, what we can see now all around the world, that for many new entrants into the labor market, and most of the new entrants into the labor markets in developing countries, that's the only access to employment, informal economy. And so we have a mass phenomenon that is persistent, even in countries with good growth performance. And that's one of the issues, because if we look at the performance of Africa for the last 10 years, you had a huge level of growth, but no impact on job creation, no impact on underemployment, no impact on informal employment. So that's an issue to think, to say no trickle down. We can't imagine or we can't wait for trickle down impact of growth into employment conditions, because otherwise we will wait too long with many problems. Another issue is the level of informal employment within the formal economy, because we don't work only on the informal economy, but what we can see now also in developed countries, Central Asia, Southern East, and Eastern Europe, you have a higher level of informal employment within the within the formal economy. So, and what we can see also is the issue, to take the problem from the perspective of social protection, and the informal people, the people who are trapped into informal employment, suffered from high exposure in risk combined with low social protection coverage, which may make them very, very vulnerable to any crisis and shocks. And so it's very important to take into account those issues, but also to take into account the main drivers of informalization within the formal economy as within the informal economy. And we can see different factors and drivers of informalization. First, the inability of growth pattern, present growth pattern, to create enough jobs to provide jobs to all the new entrants into the labor market, but also the restructuration of the global economy with new formal, informal economy linkages, which are pushing for more informal employment because of flexibility, of competitivity, of labor deregulation. The lack of an appropriate environment for sustainable formal micro, small, and medium enterprises, and all the issue of the tax issue, labor regulation issue that we have to raise also. But also a last one, which has where we have focused a lot some of our recent research, is the issue of people strategies to secure their working and living condition in an environment characterized by multiform vulnerabilities. Uh-huh. And we have launched the ILO and have managed this research program some very specific subsector studies with some surveys in some big cities of Africa, just to better understand the popular enhancing security practices in the informal economy and how they combine public policies, popular practices, NGOs, tools and programs to fight those different levels of vulnerabilities we have to fight to survive or to improve their living condition. But when we try to provide some policy frameworks to improve employment condition in the informal economy, we face a very complex reality, because the informal economy is very heterogeneous. That's one issue. You will have own account workers or employers employed in their own informal sector enterprises. You will have contributing family workers, irrespective of whether they work in the formal or in the informal sector enterprises. You will have employees holding informal jobs, whether employed by the formal economy or by the informal economy. But you will have also domestic workers. So, you know, you will have some coping practices from one side with self-employed and this kind of practices. But you will have also solidarity and social and solidarity enterprises within the informal economy. So if we want to think about an innovative policy framework to support the social and solidarity economy, we have to think also about all those issues and to see how we can upgrade those informal enterprises which can be associated to social and solidarity economy.
2 minutes.
2 minutes. And from that, what we learned and from our practice of developing policy frameworks in developing countries, is you have to have different objectives and different level of intervention to fight informal employment. You have to promote formal employment through appropriate macroeconomic policy. You have to reduce informal employment through providing business service, financial or non-financial business services, skills, way to improve productivity. And you have to increase also decent work in the informal economy. And that's very important because in the short or even medium term, we will not make disappear all the informal employment in the informal economy. So we have also to improve decent work in the informal economy. And social and solidarity enterprises are a very interesting way to improve decent work in the informal economy. And we try to think now about supporting the development of social economy enterprises and organizations. And we can see that social and solidarity enterprises could represent the most advanced pole in a strategy of upgrading social informal economy enterprises within this broader agenda of fighting informal employment and promoting decent work in the informal economy. Thanks, Amish.
Thank you very much. I like your expression, the most advanced pole in a strategy of upgrading. Now, actually, among the tools you mentioned was the need for conventional but also unconventional financial support systems, and I think that's what our last speaker, Tomas Greco, who's a specialist on these questions, will be able to enlighten us what kind of alternative finance can support the social solidarity economy.
Thank you. Is this on?
Yes.
Well, I want to thank Hamish and the UN for inviting me to address this forum today. I consider it a great opportunity and an honor to be here. I do have a PowerPoint slideshow that I had prepared, but in the 10 minutes available to me, I don't think I'm going to be able to get through it. So rather than rush through 18 or 20 slides, I'm going to take my time and just try to come up out of the blue with some ideas that I think that you ought to be aware of. Now, when I titled my last book, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization, I was entirely serious about that. Quite often I get the reaction from people, the end of money, who can imagine the end of money? Are you crazy? Well, I don't think I'm crazy, but I do have a serious lack of confidence in policy approaches to changing the status quo. And I think we've reached the limits of policy changes. We have to think in terms of top to bottom, actually bottom to top, restructuring. And so the focus of my remarks today are on the creation of moneyless exchange mechanisms that can help communities not only to weather the storm of monetary and financial turmoil that's been intensifying around the world in recent years, but also to begin the process of monetary and financial restructuring that is needed to assure the survival of civilization into what Alvin Toffler calls the third wave, and to what I refer to as the butterfly society or the convivial society. So to meet the challenges that confront us today, it's necessary to understand the broad context of power dynamics and the locus of power in the world today. And that's primarily in the sector of money and banking. Some of the quotes that I would show you if I had the PowerPoint up would indicate that pretty well-known people with credentials and in a position to know have said that whoever controls the creation of money controls everything else in society as well, from economics, finance, and politics, all the way on up. So the best that I can do in the time that I have, I think, is to throw out a few ideas about the dimensions of the predicament that we find ourselves in and approaches that we might take to get out of it. It's really quite ironic when you think that over the last 200 or 300 years, we've made tremendous advances in productivity and quality of life for some. But in spite of all that, we have poverty and squalor still widespread around the world. Now, this is not the natural order of things. This is an artifact of the structures that we have created, primarily the money and banking structures. It's not an accident. It's a consequence of our reliance upon a deeply flawed and unfair fair system of money, banking, and finance. The most pressing aspect of the global predicament, and we have a multidimensional crisis on our hands. We have resource depletion, we have pollution of all sorts, we have the financial and monetary crisis around the world, we have peak oil approaching, many other dimensions of the crisis. But the most acute aspect of that crisis is the debt crisis. And we've seen debts escalate to tremendous proportions, even in developed countries, especially in developed countries, that are supposed to be the most prosperous and rich countries in the world. In the United States, for example, in 1965, the total debt for all sectors, both public and private, amounted to about 1.5 times GDP. Now, GDP isn't a particularly good measure of economic health, but it is a measure of total economic throughput, which includes bads as well as goods. Economists like to point at GDP as a measure of growth and well-being. So in 1965 in the USA, the ratio of total debt, public and private, to GDP was about 1.5 times. Today it's approaching 4 times. That's just in the span of, 50 years. So, and it's not just the U.S. The same phenomenon has occurred in other countries around the world, in fact, even to a worse extent than in the United States. The government portion of the debt in the United States now amounts to about 1 time GDP. That is, it would take the total output of the United States in order to pay off the government debt, total output in 1 year. In the UK, on the other hand, it's more like 5 times GDP. And France and Spain and Italy and most of the EU are in dire straits as well as far as government debt is concerned. So we need to confront this debt crisis. And the powers that be tell us that the solution to the debt problem is more debt. So with the Greece bailout, for example, the IMF wants Greece to incur additional loans in the prospect of possible growth later on. And along with that, they're requiring severe cuts in social programs, which are being very detrimental to the working people and to the population generally. So what's to be done about this? The big question is, should Greece pull out of the euro? Well, I'm not going to address that question. What I think Greece should do is to allow and enable alternative exchange systems to spring up. And they are springing up spontaneously. In the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be visiting Crete and then Volos, which has been in the news lately because of their social money program. Apparently, it's a credit clearing system that they have instituted. And there are several other such systems around Greece. They're known as TEM, T-E-M. And in the workshop that I'm going to be going to in Crete that starts on the 10th and goes into the 11th of this month, we're going to be addressing the questions of alternative exchange mechanisms, which can provide liquidity to local communities. If there isn't enough official money in circulation, people will create their own exchange media, their own local currencies and credit clearing associations in order to provide local liquidity. And there's a long history of doing this, and it's often stimulated by economic and financial adversity. You can go back to the Great Depression of the 1930s, And we can see multiple examples of that. In one of my other books, the Money Book, Understanding and Creating Alternatives to Legal Tender, I give examples, both historical examples and contemporary examples, of alternative exchange mechanisms. And during the Great Depression, there were a number of so-called scrip issues that popped up all over the United States and all over Europe as well, where people in communities found ways to make up for the dearth of official money that was in circulation at the time. One classic example was in Schwanenkirchen in Bavaria, where they came up with a local currency based on the ability of a coal mine to produce coal. So you can produce local liquidity on the basis of your local production, whether that's a small amount or a large amount. And this is being done and has been done repeatedly. So what we have to do is to find ways to perfect the designs of these exchange and currency systems and then proliferate them around the world. Now, it's always been our first impulse to look to government to solve our problems for us. But we have to recognize that the political machinery has been thoroughly captured by elite interests who want to perpetuate the status quo. They've organized the system to do what it does, which is to centralize power and to concentrate wealth. And it will continue to do that as long as we allow it. Now, the first thing that we have to do is to recognize our dependence on these systems, on these corporate entities, and on these top-level political systems, and find ways to reduce our dependence on them and to create alternative structures that we can control in our communities at the local level, and then network these together into a whole new social order, what I call the butterfly society. So, fortunately, this is a peaceful and ready path toward liberation and toward empowerment. And I want to end with a quote from E.C. Riegel, who was one of my main mentors. These are a couple of Riegel's books, Flight from Inflation and A New Approach to Freedom. And Riegel said this. He said, "It is a remarkable fact that no constitution of any state nor any declaration of human rights has ever proclaimed the right of freedom of money issue. Yet this right is inseparable from the right of bargain or exchange, which is the very foundation of liberty. And man's ignorance of the laws of money has blinded him to the very touchstone of freedom, without which the state cannot be curbed or his own capacity for progress and prosperity facilitated. We stand now at the dawn of a new approach to the ages-old problem of human emancipation from superstition, with prospect of a tremendous lift to the spirit of conquest over the forces of darkness and depression." Thank you. I'll end it there.
Great. Well, thank you very much. It's very difficult to talk about these complex monetary issues in 10 minutes, but I think nothing you said was I think everyone was able to understand what you said, and these initiatives sprouting up in Greece and other parts of the world in times of crisis, you know, do provide concrete examples that this is possible. The question is whether it's as one of the implicit questions in Peter's the UNRWA study, is it just a coping mechanism, or could it be actually expanded into something that can provide a true alternative to the mainstream? So without further ado, I'd like to open the floor for discussion. I'd just like to say, obviously, if you've been in this room, it means that you understand English, but if you have real trouble speaking in English, you can speak in French, and we have Tim Anderson here from Community Forge, who can then summarize what you have to say. We have a little more than half an hour, but it would be good if you could keep your comments focused. So, and when you take the floor, if you could just introduce yourselves. So whoever would like to start. You gentlemen?
Nobody speaks French.
No, well, if you can't speak English, try to speak English, I will save time.
Do you understand me? In the field of what we call in English social and solidarity economy,
introduce yourself.
If you can introduce yourself.
Yes, my name is... Right there. Okay, my name is Fernand Vincent, and from the present here, a world network of grassroots organizations, cooperatives, in Africa, in Latin America, in Asia. And at the same time, I am the founder, 50 years ago, of the Pan-African Institute for Development, and we are now training people with MA in social economy, in social and solidarity economy. I have some remarks to do, and I am very happy to see, to listen that Unrest is working in research. And I believe that we have a different clarification to do, because it's not clear at all in this field. If you are from English-speaking countries, or if you are from the North, or if we are from Africa, you speak another language in the same field. And I will try to say that the difference is very often between what we call an economy orientated to social results, impact, and we have enterprise much more for handicapped people, unemployed people, etc., etc., but not economy. And the other way, in Africa, I'm working with peasant organizations. We are now fighting against the World Bank, who are implementing his own policy of privatization, which called appropriation of the coffee filière to them and not to the peasant. And we have to see exactly what is this, this detail. The second point is a problem of ethic. Social economy, what is that in terms of definition? What is the alternative? Alternative to what? To a model which is the liberalism, okay? If it is so, we are discussing about sharing the resources and the income, appropriation of the capital, and etc. So we have to define much more in a time of charter, the fundamental principle of what we are speaking about. And I believe that also in the field of social economy, I participated 6 months ago at the Rencontre du Mont Blanc in Chamonix, you know very well. So here we have together small group from Africa working at the village level at the Massif. Massif is, I don't know how many, but hundreds of members.
It's an insurance company, if you just to explain. Yeah.
So the question is, in fact, to make a difference and to avoid to speak only in terms of social economy with social problem and services for the small people, and it is not a model. We will have a difficulty to have a model. I am very interested to know how the social economy could enter in the economic field and be in competition with the modern sector and the capitalist sector. This is there that, in fact, we have a lot of experiences in Brazil about it, and we have to look at it into detail. This is my principal remark, but I believe that, I hope that the study of analysts will be able to look at this at these fundamental problems. Otherwise, we will be in such a conference not able to understand each other, because we don't know from whom we are speaking, for what.
Yeah. I mean, we could see those tensions as an undercurrent in the discussions in Rio, where, you know, some of these big, almost multinationals call themselves part of the social economy, but it's quite different from the type of actors that Frédéric, for example, was referring to, or Peter. And that's something that hopefully the study can help to clarify. Anyone else would like to take the floor? I see a gentleman. Yes, Yvon, I think. If you can introduce yourself.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, my name is Ivan Claude, and I'm working for an NGO in Geneva based on sustainability issues. I have a question and a remark. So maybe if you can answer my question first, then I can make my remark. So the question is for Peter. You define three categories of models for coping with the crisis. I need to understand more about the difference between the green economy model, which was the second one, and social economy, third one. Can you be more specific about the difference, please?
The models I referred to were, I call them, stabilizing market liberalism.
Okay.
The second one, embedded liberalism. And within the embedded liberalism model, I think there are two prominent features in trying to craft this sort of 21st century model of embedded liberalism, which is a sort of a new social contract. Things like expanding social policy, social services, universalization, and the global social floor idea of the ILO, and what's often called the New Green Deal, which is seeing green economy or certain variants of green economy as a way of, in a sense, dealing with not only with problems of unsustainable development, but the multiple crises of finance, energy, and food. So I saw the new social contract and what we can call the New Green Deal as two key features of the embedded liberal model. I don't know if that answers your question or clarifies it.
Yes.
You had a comment as well to make?
Yeah, basically my comment is here, we all agree with the fact that the current model is flawed, it's not working, and trying to come up with a new model is going to tackle different issues, linking environmental issues with social issues. So my question is, why are we not working on a model that's combining actually those three models? So because you asked me for papers on ESS,
right?
Yeah. SSC, sorry. I'm trying to find out the real difference between models based on green economy and models based on SSC. Yeah. I really cannot find it, that's why I was asking the question. So is it combinable, or is it completely mutually exclusive?
The green economy, what we saw in Rio in the two different events Hamish referred to, the official summit and the people's summit, in the main agenda item, the one of two main agenda items for the official summit was related to green economy. Across town in the People's Summit, there was an explicit rejection of green economy, which surprised a lot of observers that the reaction was so strong against it. The work we did through an inquiry we had last year on social dimensions of green economy, it was a slightly different take. It was saying green economy is this broad term which has a lot of buy-in from very different interests, but it's contested. It's contested by different interests and different actors. And that it's that contestation that's going to sort of shape the direction it takes. So the concern at the People's Summit is that already we're seeing the emergence of a green economy model that's dominated by transnational corporations, that's very market-focused, market-centered. And that, in turn, has a lot of social and environmental questions arise because of that sort of focus. But also within green economy, at least what we saw at our conference through our inquiry, is you have a lot of community initiatives, a lot of things going on at the local level, which are also simultaneously trying to address economic, environmental, and social objectives. So for a lot of the people participating in our inquiry, potentially that can also be subsumed, come under the green economy label. But as I say, it's a contested thing. There's no such thing as one. There's not one perspective on green economy. There are many different perspectives, and it's going to be contested. And it's the power relations involved in that contestation that will sort of shape the direction it takes.
Yeah, and I think in your presentation you were talking about the Green New Deal, which was an idea that the United Nations put forward in 2009. To deal with the global financial crisis in a way to massively invest in new types of jobs around clean energy, environmental cleanup, and so forth, which is quite different from the green economy model that was being contested in Rio, which, as you say, was market-based and you know, about financialization of nature and all the problems that may derive from that. Okay, anyone else would like to jump in? Sir? Yes, Alan.
I'm Alan Lever. I wanted to ask Peter a few questions about the way in which he was presenting the main proponents for the social and solidarity economy, and I don't know whether he was just referring to the situation in the south or in the north, because if you look at the situation in most Western European countries, the United States, and certainly Eastern Europe, the main proponents of a social and solidarity economy in the past have been the trade unions and their political allies and the cooperative movement. Now, the present situation, the trade union movement in many countries has halved in membership, particularly its members in the private sector. The co-op movement has shrunk enormously from what benefits the co-op used to provide across a whole range of social welfare provisions. So in many ways, their voice has been reduced. And therefore, if that voice is down, how much are they going to be able to contribute to the social and solidarity economy, particularly in the north? And in addition to that, nothing was said about employer organizations in general and their attitude towards the social and solidarity in the economy, and especially their attitudes towards any expansion of organized labor. In fact, in the present situation, it's become more and more difficult to organize right the way across the private sector because employers are making it difficult for organizations in any form, whether they're staff associations or trade unions, to organize. I mean, in Eastern Europe, it's a disaster in many countries. The attitude of employers is totally against any form of organized labor, and in fact, people are victimized. There's very little freedom of association and collective bargaining at all. So I wonder how, when we look at some of the forces that exist in our economy and political economy now, and we weigh those up against alternatives, what opportunity is there, and how are those voices going to be strengthened? I suppose that's for Peter and also for Frederick from the ILO.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question about the power dynamics, in a sense. I was wondering whether anyone else would, from the room would like to jump in on that question. If not, okay.
Could I say one thing?
Yeah,
about
sure.
As far as co-ops are concerned, there's one exception to what you said, and that's the Mondragon cooperatives in Spain. And that's a model worth studying. And I think we can learn a lot from their structures and their approaches. But you have to recognize also on another point that for corporations, labor is an expense, and they try to minimize expense as much as possible. That's why we've seen so much manufacturing move out of the United States and into the third world, one country after another, first Mexico, then Latin America, then East Asia, and so that's going to continue. The answer, I think, is to reduce our dependence on large corporations. I think the trend is going to be towards small-scale manufacturing, like the flexible manufacturing networks in northern Italy, where you have small enterprises networking together to take on larger projects that they can't do by themselves.
On your statement, Alan, about the decline of trade unions and cooperatives, I'm wondering how to what extent we can generalize on the cooperative side. I mean, if you look at the work of the ILO and Roberto de Meglio, who's here, has been working very much on social and solidarity economy issues and cooperatives in the ILO. But there have been two excellent readers they did in 2010 and 2011 on sort of mapping out the social economy field, and a recent book on cooperatives. I mean, it points to, you know, sort of significant revival in certain regions, so in particular, I think, South America and Africa. So I think we see sort of regional variations in that. On the question of trade unions, yes, obviously over 20 plus years, we've seen sort of trade unions going much more on the defensive and being weakened politically. I guess the question, interesting questions are, in terms of power relations or the possibility of transforming power relations, are we starting to see trade unions sort of reverting to the strategies of the early 20th century of trying to be, where the labor movement tried to be hegemonic in the sense of also allying, building broad-based coalitions with other civil society entities, trying to form alliances, coalitions, etc., and not just focus on their own particular interests, but also take up broader issues associated, you know, which we associate now with, say, the global justice movement. And in the People's Summit in Rio, we saw signs of that. It was quite uplifting in that sense to see the sort of the coming together of trade unions and NGO networks and social movements. So that's sort of one question I have on that. And the other, of course, is we see, in some respects, trade unions having been weakened, but we also see new forms of trade unions arising, particularly in relation to this whole area of own account workers, informal sector workers, the sort of street net federation, the Sewas in India, etc. So unionization being much more associated with informal economy. So I think some interesting changes are taking place there. I'll leave the question on employers' organizations for the ILO.
Would you like to add something?
Thanks, Peter. I think that's an important issue. I think now you have a consensus from the employer and the trade union side about the need to tackle the issue of informal employment for different reasons. But from the employer side, one of our main issues is the issue of unfair competition. You know, most of the enterprises within the informal economy are not paying taxes, and they complain because most of the members of employers' organizations are formal, and you have some pressure from their members to tackle the issue of informal employment because of unfair competition. From trade unions, for the last 10 years, you had huge efforts from trade unions to organize informal workers. So for a long time at the ILO, perhaps they were less supportive of the informal economy workers because the level of representation of traditional trade unions were not so high in the informal economy. So putting the emphasis on informal economy workers would open the door to new stakeholders, you know, in the ILO. But now, because of the level of organization of the informal economy workers and how they bridge those new organizations, they bridge to traditional or formal trade unions organizations, they are much more supportive to this issue of dealing with informal employment. And it's the same, you know, for the governments, because it's one of our constituents, because of the issue of fiscal space. Because it's a crisis, because they need resources, because they need fiscal space, they put also strong emphasis on the issue of transition to formality from this tax issue. So for very different reasons, they have not the same reasons to promote the informal employment agenda within the ILO, but for the different reasons, we can see an emerging consensus about the need to deal with this issue. And perhaps on this issue, you know, what is social economy? And I think in the research we did, you know, at micro level, so how decision making is What about the decision making at the unit level in the informal economy? You know, the main factor is not profit, it's securitization. The issue, how to deal with vulnerability. And that's why, you know, it's difficult sometimes to think about social and solidarity economy and informal economy units, because, you know, the main objective of informal economy units, because of a very high level of vulnerabilities, is to secure their living and working condition of their members. So, you know, and it's profit is not it's one of the variables, but it's one variable among many other. And coordination will not be through prices most of the time, but through other variables. And it's very important to put into to have a special focus on those issues of vulnerabilities and securitization practices of informal economy units at collective and individual level.
Great. Thank you very much. Gentlemen there, and then you.
Hello, I'm Christine Ansberger from the University of Louvain in Belgium, working on currency issues and monetary issues. And I just feel that, not because he's the one coming from furthest, but I think Tom Greco's points are being sort of underestimated or not taken into account sufficiently right now in the discussion. I mean, when we talk, for example, about securitization and not in the banking sense, so securing the functioning of the more vulnerable in the social and solidarity economy, it seems to me the whole issue of what Mr. Greco calls, and I mean, I don't know if he mentioned it that way, but political money versus, we could call it social money, is absolutely crucial. Because actually, it seems to me, a lot of social policy debates, especially around grassroots organizations, sort of miss the point that the traditional, the only money that we have around for now, which is bank debt money, is actually created by a specific mechanism, which Mr. Greco has outlined, and it acts in many cases as a true bottleneck on the possibilities for organizations to spring up. So it's not as if you can just, it seems to me, that's why I'm saying it's understated. I mean the whole money reform debate is taking up speed now, but I think still not sufficiently, because many people don't realize that if you're working on development, you have to take into account the fact that the way organizations are going to be able to spring up will always be, in the current system, constrained and held back by, for example, credit rationing. So, I mean, of course, people like Joe Stiglitz and people have struggled their whole lives to integrate credit or of course, the Grameen Bank and so on, traditional credit money into development economics, and you can do that, and it's important. But I think with these clearing currencies and more generally complementary social currencies, we have a huge toolbox to add, right? And even to short-circuit the bottleneck of standard bank debt money, which has its own logic and which sort of goes often, at least, goes against the interests of grassroots development organizations. I just wanted to reemphasize that.
Yeah, I think you were very eloquent.
If I might.
Yeah.
Thank you, Christian, for raising that point. You know, democracy has two aspects. There's political democracy and economic democracy. And we live in an economic despotism worldwide. And really, we can never have true political democracy until we have economic democracy. And we can only achieve economic democracy by transcending the global central banking debt money system. So, you know, we're going to start at the local level, but ultimately these local exchanges have to be networked together. So we're creating a new system of exchange, which is locally based, locally controlled, but globally useful. So don't think of local currencies in terms of the local currencies that you're familiar with. Those are experiments that have gone on over the last 30 years or so, and going back to the Great Depression even longer than that. But this is the beginning of a whole new way of doing money, banking, and exchange. And we have to look at it that way, and we have to develop it in such a way that it can be scaled up and networked together into a global network.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in a way, the SSE is marginalized in the mainstream development debates, and the whole currency dimension, which is so central, has been marginalized. And this is a very useful encounter in that. Next gentleman.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Christophe Plass. I'm from Virtuosongo, Prosperity Changemaker Support. My question is for Mr. Greco Jr. and Mr. Arspenger, that we have the opportunity to have here. It's concerning the fact that we agreed that rethinking monetary and economic system, wealth accountancy, exchange and motivation tools are necessary to improve solidarity economic network development, especially through complementary and social currencies dissemination, as you said, Mr. Greco. And can you give us three ideas in order to reach the tipping point, to increase the scale, and to sustain those innovative tools in terms of financial support, competencies, empowerment, human resources, and impact assessment? Because nowadays, this sector is still a niche, as microcredit was maybe 15 years ago, and we need to scale it up in order to reach this point. Thank you very much.
Well, the problem has been that many of the exchange system models have been inadequate, that local currencies that have been tried have been issued on an improper basis. The proper basis of issue for a currency is local production. So a lot of currencies have issued currency to anybody and everybody, and then they try to recruit the local business people to accept it. So that's like my spending my notes, my IOUs into the economy and asking somebody else to redeem them for me. And of course, that doesn't work in the long run, because you end up with the most popular businesses accumulating currency that they can't spend. So I tell organizers that the ones that you want to accept the currency are the ones that ought to issue it in the first place. So if you have a local producer that's producing something that everybody wants, they can add to local liquidity by issuing their own currency, by paying their workers and their suppliers in that currency and then accepting it back for the value that they produce, whatever that is. Now, as far as models are concerned, I'm often asked, well, where can we see a working model that's been successful? And the best one that I can think of is right here in Switzerland. It's called Vir. Wirtschaftsring, I think, if my pronunciation is anywhere near correct. And it was started in the Great Depression by the small and medium-sized businesses, the SMEs, as we call them. And because there was a dearth of official currency in circulation at the time, they found this way to create their own exchange mechanisms through this credit clearing circle. And that's been ongoing now for almost 80 years, and it still transacts about $2 billion worth of trades. And there are about 60,000 businesses throughout the country in Switzerland that are members of the VIR. Now, the VIR has, within the last 20 years, become a conventional bank. I won't go into what I think are the reasons for that, but they're doing conventional banking activities, but they still continue this credit clearing process amongst the VIR members. So it's not a perfect model, but it certainly has been sustainable and successful. And we can improve on that model and proliferate it around the world.
Can I just, since I
you're next.
Called on, just another idea, since you asked for ideas for implementation. Let me just add, Bernard Lyotard was a co-author and colleague of mine. Main point lately has been to say, there's the whole clearing money question, and how best to design the currencies. But when you do have local currencies or any sort of currency circulating, and that's the case of the VIR, if you ask business people in Basel, for example, if they like the VIR, they don't all like it because they have to accept it. And it's not real money, as they say, by which they mean basically they have to get rid of it quickly before the end of the year, because why? They cannot pay any taxes with it. So one idea for implementation of local currencies would be that at some level of power, be it municipal or local, a fraction of the taxes might be payable legally in the complementary currency, which would enhance its attractivity.
It would be make it necessary to hold that currency in some monetary theory.
No, even desirable.
No,
yes,
not hold it.
But I mean to accept it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's some monetary theory says that it's. The lady and then Pascal.
Thanks very much to the panelists and Maria Mercedes Rossi from EPG23. I would like just to make a comment on the issue of the definition of social economy and solidarity economy filtered through the issue of securitization, which is an important aspect. But in our experience as association, we've got example of this kind of economy, of social solidarity economy, but also of many other best practices and good practices that are all around the world. One of the main focus of social solidarity economy is not only securitization for basic needs of people and so on, it's just to affirm the human dignity of the person and the human right to work of every person, the duty and the right to work, the link by the issue of profit, by the issue of productivity. Of course, all these new examples of social and solidarity economy are then also in the real world, so they have to confront themselves with competitiveness and so on. And there are successful measures of it, but there are successful measures, examples, that are really entering in the circle of competition with productivity and a margin of profit, giving priorities to all the other things. But there are also examples that are successful, even if they don't produce a profit. Maybe sometimes are in deficit, but throughout other coping mechanisms of local communities, of association, can manage the same to give a different message to the world. So I would like also to highlight this point. It's a matter also of human rights affirmation, of human dignity before profit, of the fact that the work and the money is for the man, not the man for money and profit. Thanks.
Great. I think next was Pascal Delisle.
Je vais parler en français. Non, je ne voulais pas parler, je voulais juste que cette dame qui levait la main depuis un moment puisse parler. Mais je voulais dire que j'étais tout à fait d'accord avec la prochaine étape pour les monnaies complémentaires, qui est de s'articuler avec les gouvernements locaux pour rentrer dans des systèmes de contributions locales, d'impôts, de taxation locale, et aussi... de se mettre au service d'une relocalisation de l'économie avec les petites et moyennes entreprises, pas seulement l'économie sociale et solidaire, mais aussi les petites et moyennes entreprises, pour remailler du développement local en deux.
So Tim will translate in English.
Just a brief summary, actually, that she agreed with what was said earlier about getting local authorities to accept the currency, as well as integrating SMEs in the complementary currency acceptance trading circles.
Yeah, and it's part, I mean, also the SSC could be part of the kind of relocalization agenda to bring balance between the global and the local. That was, I think, another point made. Now, the lady in yellow, and then Camille.
Thank you. Caroline Sapum, Safe Observer International Journal of People's Health. Since I came in earlier, I had the pleasure to read your introduction, Mr. Jenkins, to your book, and I think it's saying a lot of very interesting things, and that'll be the call for a heterodox macroeconomic approach. Now, I think you don't go as far as we could go, however, because when you're saying that stimulus and other measures to limit the damage of the global recession have not sufficiently focused on employment and social protection. I think on the face of it, when you look at it from an ideologic standpoint, the measures that are being taken are not measures to reduce the debt. This is what is being used to sell it to the public. What those measures intend to do is to really smash the labor force and to dismantle social protection. Now, you know, if we talk about solidarity economy and social economy, Mr. Pierre, you mentioned social protection. I mean, social protection in terms of unemployment, retirement, in terms of labor laws, in terms of health, this is really a big part of the social and solidarity economy. And this is what is targeted for destruction now in Europe. I mean, it's very clear, and other people besides me have said it. Now, the problem we have, I think, is that as those, and often our governments are not even completely aware what they're doing, okay? So you have the forces, the financial forces behind the scenes and the think tanks shaping those policies that will actually destroy the European economies in very short notice, I think. And while they do that, since they cannot do that without social damage, then what they do at the same time is they give a lot of play in the media and everything to local coping mechanisms within an overall targeting approach. In other words, you target the very poor, you target this group or that group, and you propose to this or that group a form of solidarity economy. I'm trying to point out a paradox. I wonder if Peter or others can comment on that, because that's another aspect, that's a solidarity economy which we could hope for is actually today being used to pass very, what I would call, fascistic kind of economic policy in the very, very short term.
Yes. Well, this is another observation that I have is... And I use the analogy of the human body. It's like all the resources are being channeled into the cancerous tumor and in the process starving the body politic. So the powers that be tell us that we have to cut social programs in order to balance national budgets. They're not talking about raising taxes or about changing the structures of the economy at all. But, you know, that's what we need to do. And if they're not going to do it from the top down, we've got to do it from the bottom up. So that means looking to ourselves and organizing ourselves at the community level to provide what we need as much at the community level. But there will always be imports and exports out of any economy, whether it's a national economy or a regional economy. But that has been taken to ridiculous extremes. We import Australian oranges into California. How can that be any... how can you find anything more ridiculous than that? So it benefits a few who have structured this global economy in the way it has, but it hurts the majority. So we need a thorough restructuring, starting with the financial and... banking system.
Anyone else would like to add on that?
Yes. No, what your point, Garance, I think in these circles here in the UN, it's crucial to refer to that. It's a bit the sort of the elephant in the room syndrome. And we have a tendency in these sort of circles to identify what we think as some sort of innovation, positive innovations that are emerging, sort of best practices, and assume this is there's a powerful sort of dynamic and momentum behind these. And sometimes we lose sight of the what else is going on. So the response to crisis isn't just to stabilize the system, re-legitimize the system, move towards some sort of social contract, as I mentioned. There's also capital trying to restructure. It's commodifying, it's looking for new sources of surplus and profitability, it's trying to commodify nature, it's trying to flexibilize, as you said, labor relations, it's trying to privatize services. And all of those tendencies and processes are highly contradictory from a social and environmental perspective. and we need always to bear in mind those two sort of dynamics that are playing out.
Camille, if you can introduce yourself.
Good afternoon. My name is Camille Bjørnstehan. I chair Eco Attitude, small association, a citizen association in Geneva. We are no experts, we are bottom-up people, and we are trying to do something about what we see coming. We advocate local currencies and try to work on it. There is an open workshop for people here in Geneva who want to join us. But we have another idea, and I'd like to ask Thomas Greco what he thinks about it, to make economy more solidary. We think of unconditional basic income. Do you have any opinion on that measure?
I do. I believe in a citizen's dividend. When you consider that the birthright of all people is the earth, that the earth wasn't produced by anyone, it was here and it's our common heritage, and private property is good. But private property ownership should compensate those who are excluded. So that's the basis for a citizen's dividend. Whether we do that through national governments or by some other means, that's an open question.
But I didn't quite understand what you mean by citizen's dividend.
Well, a citizen's dividend. Henry George spoke about this more than 100 years ago. And his way of dealing with it was to tax land sites and take the taxes off of labor, take the taxes off of real estate improvements, tax only the site, with the rationale that the land is our common heritage. Nobody produced it. And if you go back far enough in tracing titles, land was always taken from somebody else by force. But I consider that every privilege, including the corporate charter, which gives the privilege of limited liability, ought to be taxed, and that tax ought to be used as a basis for paying everyone a subsistence income, so that people can do the work that's meaningful and important to them rather than the work that they have to do in order to pay the rent and put food on the table.
And can that work in the South too?
Well, I think it can work anywhere. But it's going to require a major change in mindset and a major change in the way we approach economics. And trying to get central governments to do it, I think, is a major hurdle. I think people have to empower themselves first at the community level. And taking charge of the exchange process and the currency is a major necessity in doing that.
Well, thank you for all these nice exchanges. I'm going to be a bit provocative there. I think there's one issue that has not...
Could you just introduce yourself?
Yes, okay. I'm Natasha Wart. I came with Community Forge, but I represent my own point of view when I speak here. So okay, just to make it clear. And there's one thing that you have not spoken about, apart maybe a little bit, Peter, who has spoken about women empowerment. Now, in Switzerland, 63%, well, unpaid work represents 63% of the GDP, and that is mostly the work of women, men, but also women. And I think these complementary currencies approach offer a huge potential for the recognition of unpaid work. So I'd like to have your advice on that. Thank you.
You might, or I don't know, you have something to say?
No, you're totally right. The gender issue is a very important issue in all the researches we do at the ILO. Because we know, as I said, we must be very specific in our policy frameworks. And, you know, so we try to do specific researches on subsectors. And from one sector to another, the gender dimension will be very important. In developing countries, catering or small restaurants, street restaurants, you will have mostly women, but for others. So we have to take care of that dimension. It's very important.
Maybe I can say something. You have to recognize a distinction between social value and market value. And why don't more things that are of social value have market value? That's the key question. And the primary reason is because markets are typically dominated by large corporations and large players. And so until we get around that market dominance problem, social value is going to continue to have a diminished market value.
Yes, sorry. I mean, just to add a little element to what you were suggesting, I think you're perfectly right. The advantage in particular of exchange systems and clearing currencies is that they are born within an exchange. You don't have to borrow the money first from a bank or get it from a state which itself got it through taxes which were paid through borrowed money. It's money that springs up in the exchange, and so it can actually express, it can tie in men and women into local sort of economic exchanges, and it can also, it will of course help probably a lot of activities which are carried out in a non-market value fashion to become visible and valued, not given money value or necessarily, but valued symbolically and actually in an exchange ring, when they are given vouchers to be exchanged against services and so on. And that helps put more visibility and balance and equality into gender issues as well, I'm sure.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, we've already overstretched our time, but I don't know if there's any burning last question. I don't see. I see one gentleman at the back. Yes.
One gentleman burning. Mm.
Just a suggestion. Will we be seeing your ideas in print and perhaps one of the ILO publications?
Both would like to respond to that. There are links to. I mean, ILO has already produced a lot of stuff, and if you sign on the sheet, we could probably
provide you
with a bibliography and. The numbers for you haven't published anything.
No, we're right, and in this area we're at the beginning of the process. But yes, that's what we do. We do research and publish books and articles. So a lot of that will be eventually appearing on our website.
If I might just say a final word, you can access my work on my website beyondmoney.net. It's beyondmoney.net. And my books are available through Amazon.com. I don't know if you have that in Europe. I suppose you do.
UK.
But the UK has Amazon.uk, and there is a UK edition of this book. It has a different appearance than this one, but it's the same content.
It's a UK pound, not a US dollar on the cover. Okay, well, thank you, everybody. I don't know if anyone else has some last comments to make, but I think this was a very useful exchange also between different trends and this whole question of the currency and the money system. I hope this seminar contributed to show that it is an important component of this whole inquiry. And with this, wishing you well, and hopefully we could all gather, if there are not other events in the meantime, on this for sure. On
May 6th, 7th, and 8th?
Probably here in Geneva at the Palais des Nations to take stock of all the great writings that will happen thanks to Henri's research. And please do contribute abstracts to see if these could be part of the shortlist of papers to be discussed at that conference. So thank you very much and enjoy the rest of the final session of the program.
Check out our other podcasts available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. If you have any suggestions for future podcasts, email us at press@unris.org. Thank you for listening.